I think we might kick off so that we have maximum amount of time to discuss. So welcome everyone. First of all, I'd like to congratulate the organising committee for arranging this financial services forum right before the budget. I'm sure they did actually have that in mind. Because what I find most interesting about this particular forum is that super for change and retirement incomes are right at the forefront of the budget in terms of changes in the age pension, what government pension's going to cost, etc., and what changes need to be made. So yes, the Institute, we've been speaking about this for a number of years, but actually it's out in the community now, and I think there's a bit more discussion actually happening in at that level. So Tony and Bill's presentation looks at the history of defined benefit funds, where it's at now, and how that can actually help us search for insights, lessons about the current situation, what do we do with that post-retirement dilemma. It's also going to be a bit of discussion around the wind-up of defined benefit funds, as you know, pretty much a dying institution in themselves. So let me move on to a bit of background for our two speakers. First speaker is going to be Tony Miller. Tony's a senior consultant for Russell Investments based in Melbourne. He specialises in advice to a wide range of superannuation funds, including advice in the areas of actuarial management, operations, compliance, outsourcing, risk and investment structures. He joined Russell's in 2009. He's have over 30 years of experience. Sorry, Tony, didn't actually mean to say 2000. But, before joining Russell, Tony was a principal with Butler Walker, formerly Rice Walker, and worldwide partner for Mercer's, including heading up the Adelaide office during that time. He's worked widely with public and private sector clients, including a range of industry and other not-for-profit funds. Tony's a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries of Australia and an active member of the Association of Super Funds of Australia, ASFA. I'll also introduce Bill at this time, and he will be our second speaker. Bill Butler, he's also got more than 30 years in the super industry, both in traditional defined benefit funds and also multiple multi-employer accumulation funds, including retail and non-commercial funds. Bill's an extensive experience in the provision of superannuation advice in the areas of insurance and actuarial management. So the two have been working together quite closely, and I'm sure that their presentation will demonstrate that. Before joining Russell in 2013, Bill was a senior consultant at Rice Warner, also at Deloitte's, and principal with Butler Walker and Actuaries. Bill's current convener for the Institute's Superannuation Projections and Disclosure Subcommittee. So, Tony will speak first, so please welcome him to the lectern.
Thank you all for coming. Who would have thought about that you'd see the expression Neanderthal, missing link and defined benefits all in the one sentence? Who would have expected that? But of course, who would have come to a session that was called Managing Defined Benefits in Their Declining Years? I think I can see a few people who are under the age of 50 here. I'm not sure what you're doing here, and does your boss know you're in this session? It is before lunch, and this topic could conceivably be vast or compacted. We've gone for the compacted version. There's a lot of material here, and I have no doubt that as we touch on items that you'll have questions and things you might want to raise afterwards, so we'll have time for discussion. In essence, we thought it'd be interesting just to draw some loose parallels between the fate of the Neanderthals as they were overwhelmed by Homo sapiens, and draw a loose artistic license parallel between defined benefit funds as they are overwhelmed by defined contribution funds, and see what we might learn out of that process as an interesting exercise. We're going to cover some history. As I said, it's a very large subject, touching on items, and then use that as a base to see what we might learn out of the Neanderthal DB link, and then look at actually some of the more serious issues that are facing people who are running defined benefit funds now as they lose their size and materiality in the overall market. But as you, many of you would know, there are still plenty of issues for defined benefit funds. Let's first of all look at the Neanderthals. And look, I've got no anthropological training. Everything I know about this subject I learnt from watching television with my grandson, walking with cavemen, walking with dinosaurs, etc., from reading Stephen Jay Gould or from the National Geographic. I'm sure a lot of you would have had the National Geographic at your bedside table. What I do know, though, from that, for sure, is that the Neanderthals have had bad press. Right? They're portrayed in the market as cartoon characters, the dunderhead cavemen, ill-equipped for their times. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth, as the more research is revealing a lot more about the Neanderthals. Certainly they are not the missing link. The missing link is a long way in the past, and the Neanderthals were, in fact, a very close cousin of Homo sapiens, as we'll see, closer than perhaps you might have thought. The Neanderthals demonstrated tremendous skills in hunting. They built shelters. There's evidence they had language. They had clothing. They communicated with each other. As a species, they had art. So quite a developed race of people who survived a very long time, and one might say were very well adapted to their times, as, you might say, so were defined benefits. But they weren't so well adapted that they were able to survive the last ice age. So the last remaining evidence of Neanderthals is around 30,000 years ago. I think we'll find more and more as more discoveries are made over time, but that looks like about the crossover point. They'd been living in Europe and Asia and Eastern Asia for a long time, coexisting with Homo sapiens. Why did they die out? The debate continues to develop, but some of the stories include they were simply wiped out by Homo sapiens. Who would have thought that humans would have had that capacity to wipe out another species? It could be that, in fact, they were driven to the extremities in the Ice Age and basically were just not able to cope with the extremes of climate at the time. There's evidence of cannibalism in Neanderthal campsites. Perhaps cannibalism and the associated diseases that can get into communities was the problem. But there's more suggestion now that, in fact, they were overwhelmed genetically by Homo sapiens. I'll let you ponder on that, and we'll come back to that a little later. But a species adapted for their times, but ultimately were not able to survive a great shock. While we're thinking about evolution, nice to just to look at a few of the characters who've been involved in the evolutionary studies. There's a couple of people up here. I'm not sure whether you recognise all of these characters. Some, I guess, will be familiar to you. Of course, the first one was Charles Darwin. Did anybody spot Charles Darwin, who had a great role, obviously, in real evolution? On the other side, we have a few gentlemen whose studies have or will, we think, shape the financial markets in Australia. Stan Wallace, with the Wallace Inquiry, which affected a lot of the prudential requirements and so on, basically the birth of APRA. The Campbell Inquiry, which had a lot to say about financial markets and the deregulation. Everybody's familiar with Jeremy Cooper's report, which doesn't actually say a lot about defined benefit, but has a lot to say about superannuation, of course. And we wait to see what David Murray has to say, but that might be another nail in the coffin for defined benefits. Look, defined benefits, clearly a product equipped for their times for a long time, deriving from the desire of employers to look after their employees, the long-serving employees. And so much of design was about holding people in employment, rewarding people at the end of their long periods of employment And that was an appropriate structure, it would seem, for many employers or who were lucky enough to have access to those schemes and who were lucky enough to survive long enough to get the benefits from those schemes. But times changed, and you can see from this chart that from about the late 70s, early 80s, the whole superannuation market changed apace, really, and superannuation went from being something that was bestowed upon employees by their employers to something that was really the right of the individual. A complete change in emphasis there. It became a benefit that a person was their own benefit. It wasn't something that they were beholden to their employer for. And the legislation gradually and persistently continued to evidence that. And as that happened, and obviously through that, we saw the growth of the DC funds, which was a natural fit into that environment, ultimately down to the last stages of defined benefit, where we're seeing it being micromanaged effectively by APRA under SPS 160. But meanwhile, many material changes occurred. Now, the things that actually, I guess, caused DB to disappear are many and varied. And in some cases, they were not fit for their times. And we'll cover a few of those as we go along. I don't think it was a case of just one particular event. There are a number of things that caused it. And many of you will have your own views on that. I think it was a range of effects. But ultimately, they proved to be not fit for their times as they developed. But having said that, there's still quite a bit of money left in DB. So those of you who are working in it will know that there's still a lot of activity in that sector. So for actuaries, there's actually still quite a lot to do. And in some ways, it's getting more and more complex as defined benefit schemes fall less in the focus of the regulators and are forced to adapt to the changing circumstances. It seems like life always gets more complicated and a whole lot of new challenges arise. So while they may be a dead end in one sense, there's still a lot of activity for managing those schemes. Of course, we heard today that the last open public sector DB fund is closing. Unless the soldiers have something to say about it, they've got the guns, of course. They may decide they don't like the idea of their defined benefit scheme being closed, but I'm guessing we'll see that happen. So quite a lot of assets in the sector. Just a point about this particular chart, which is drawn from APRA statistics. There's a reasonable amount of money that's pure DC from hybrid funds in here. So although it's an indication of defined benefit fund assets, it's not all DB assets. But nevertheless, that's a lot of money to be thinking about and a lot of challenges that still arise from that sector. It's impossible to think about DB and its evolution and where we are without thinking about the statutory framework, the legislation that's affected superannuation. I mean, when Bill and I started in the industry 40 years ago, effectively the legislation was negligible, really, apart from the 30-20 rule, which some of you will remember, and some very weak levels of taxation. Effectively no legislation had a great influence on the design of plans, which not surprisingly were lump sum. There were no requirements to be pensions, and that was the situation we found ourselves in. But, of course, if you make something so attractive from a tax perspective, you must expect tax planning to take place, and we saw the growth of tiny DB funds and the reaction of the legislation to start to impose controls upon defined benefit funds, largely driven for taxation purposes. Look, I remember when I first started work, insurance salesmen were selling defined benefit plans for any employer with 10 members or 5 members. When we think about it now, it just seems ridiculous, but it was all the go then, doing work on one-man DB plans and so on. Inevitably, that wasn't going to last, and the legislation really weighed in on us. And then we had surcharge as a key point, which brought home, I think, to members that this was something that might affect them, because the surcharge was a very individual tax, and it gave people a much better sense of that. The legislation continues to grow. We really know how defined benefit funds have continued to be weighed down by more and more legislation, partly because defined benefit is an afterthought, of course. The legislation is now all about DC plans and the associated types of funds. DB kind of comes afterwards, and if we get all these solutions that kind of fit in around that. I will mention quickly the accounting impact. I don't think we can move through defined benefit without recognising that the accounting standards really made CFOs think about what DB funds were doing to their balance sheets, and of course changing markets showed how what a real impact it could have, and had CFOs clamouring all over the world to close DB funds, many of which in Australia were of course closed because the time was right, because there was surplus to do it, but times have changed. But we shouldn't underestimate the effect of accounting in what's happened. We now have the, as I mentioned, the regulator trying to micromanage our funds. They say they don't want to manage the funds, but in fact the legislation says exactly the opposite. They really do want to micromanage the funds. Many of you will be familiar with what's required and the layers of work we now have to do. Has that added anything, to be honest? Has that added anything to the outcomes? Well, if you're the regulator, then you'll be comforted that there's perhaps less chance of some bad events happening, of which there's very little record of having happened before. I make the point that APRA has also weighed into self-insurance, and my guess is that over time a lot of members may well regret that in the end the product they get from insurance may not be as good as had some of the self-insurers been allowed to continue. We'll see where that takes us, but I don't think that was APRA's best decision. How effective has it been? Just simply, the GFC kind of put funds to the test. A lot of funds moved into an unsatisfactory financial position. A lot of financial plans went into place. Most of them had to be rewritten a couple of years later because they were still failing. But now we find that most of those plans are now out of being an unsatisfactory financial position. And the main reason is the markets. It hasn't been the funding plans, with there are exceptions to that, I will say, but largely it's been the markets. In other words, that was really a pretty large waste of company capital there. It's easy to understand why the regulator would want to do that. If you're the regulator, you might come up with something similar, but the reality is a lot of money went into funds that didn't need to be there, and now those funds are now in a healthy position, and the markets really did it. At least they were the funds that didn't overreact and go conservative when they hit the bottom. I shouldn't forget the Neanderthal theme again before we go on. A very interesting study has now been able to isolate the DNA of Neanderthals. And that work has been able to demonstrate through analysis that about 4% of Neanderthal DNA is found in Homo sapiens of European, Asian, or East Asian descent. So for a lot of us, there's a bit of Neanderthal in us. So the Neanderthal DNA is not lost. Perhaps the DB DNA will not be lost. But it's also a point of, if you think about the evolution and the survival of the fittest, maybe some of that Neanderthal DNA has been to our benefit. The jury's still out on that, but it would suggest that possibly the reason for the decline of the Neanderthals was simply interbreeding with Homo sapiens and the small Neanderthal populations simply being overwhelmed by Homo sapiens. I don't want to go any further because the next headline could look pretty ugly about what was going on in the European forest in the dark and all that sort of things. Quickly, in the DNA of DB, what did they offer? And these are familiar things that many of you will know. Some of the advantages of DB, which largely are benefits to the employees. Benefits related to retirement needs, for example, managing sequencing risk, which of course we didn't know it was sequencing risk then, but we do know it's sequencing risk now. For those pension plans, it was a way to manage longevity. So there were promises of DB and advantages. There are, of course, disadvantages, and a lot of those disadvantages fall on the employer side, although the employers have often benefited from the investment returns of those plans as well. But it's the shortcomings, of course, which caused the problems. I mentioned the last point, inequity, and there I'm referring to the emergence of the strong investment returns in plans. So the large surpluses in plans, which the DB members were really not able to access, and DB members sitting in plans, seeing that those investment returns, wondering whether they were getting the right deal, and in many cases that sort of thinking and those surpluses helped lead to the decline of the DB funds. I think that was a significant contributor to that. Has DB delivered on the promise? Just very quickly, because I think I'm running out of time here. We did some very simple examples. Everybody in the room will come up with their own examples and have a counter example to these very simple cases. But I think it just highlights a point we're trying to make here. DB has this image of being very fit for purpose. and providing the benefits people need in retirement. A reality is that many of the benefits that we thought were so generous in DB funds now would fail the adequacy tests that are now in the marketplace. We simply designed a very simple plan based on a 9.25% contribution rate, used some very simple assumptions, and compared a DB fund and a DC fund, very simple to do. We then thought, well, what happens if the investment returns a bit better, as actually was the reality? And, of course, very quickly you see the DC plan gets ahead of the DB plan. And what about the circumstances of a lot of retirees who actually find that their salary growth is a lot less than in their later years than it was in early years? Not true of all circumstances, particularly in industrial environments. But the DB plan starts to fall away. And, again, that was something that members of DB funds discovered when markets went ahead, and it was another contributor towards declining DB funds. And you'll say, well, what about volatility and all those things? Well, absolutely true, and there's plenty of examples of members who were very glad they were in a DB fund during the GFC and so on. But taken over a career, we've just compared our DB fund with a DC fund with the actual returns from the last 30 years, and you can see that the DC fund is still ahead on that basis. I know in my own case I've worked out, should I have stayed in my original employer's DB fund or was I better off in a DC fund? And it turns out I'm better off in a DC fund. So while DB may have been fit for purpose, the question is it probably started to fail that test and was therefore vulnerable to the modern equivalent of an ice age. But we still need to manage DB funds during the remainder of their lives and in their decline, and Bill's going to help us illustrate those points.
Thank you, Tony. I'm going to start off with what seems like a bit like flogging a dead horse, what you do with a closed DB fund, and I'm going to spend a bit of time on that and then move on to what we can learn from the DB legacy, how that might be useful, particularly in the current environment where we're looking at long-term retirement planning. So when I first started and first got involved with defined benefit funds, I think I probably spent 50% of my time designing new funds and calculating contribution rates for new funds, which doesn't happen nowadays. We've got a whole raft of different issues to handle in looking after closed funds. At this stage, I'd just like to apologise to anyone here who represents an open DB fund, because there are a few. Yes, there is one there. And some of this does apply to open funds, of course. So looking back at the history that Tony has been covering, I think the turning point for DB was probably when the 3% productivity contributions came in the 80s. And suddenly, employers who had DB funds for their staff had to think, OK, I've now got to put some of my wages employees somewhere. And rather than start a new fund, aha, I can put them in the DB fund, and it's quite simple. We can just have an accumulation there. So at that stage, DC became an add-on to existing DB funds. Lots of other issues, of course, lots of other types of funds. But that's the first infiltration. And at that stage, there were generally no insurance cover and perhaps no expense deductions. So all expenses came out of the DB portion. And as they started to add in insurance cover, the premiums would start to come out of their member accounts, but it would still go via the DB fund. And that seemed like a very good arrangement at the time. What happened, and this is very similar to the Neanderthal legacy as well, whereby the defined benefit funds started to become overwhelmed by the growth of the DC components. And this has caused some of the issues that we have to deal with nowadays in managing a hybrid DB-DC fund. So first of all, you have the issue of scale. I've dealt with plans where there are so few members that it's costing the employer thousands of dollars per member just to look after the actuarial compliance aspects of the plan. But that's often a more palatable alternative than trying to get rid of those members, and it's easier just to let them run through until they all retire. More seriously, though, there are cash flow management issues. So in that model that I just presented previously, you could see where costs were going via DB. So, for example, With insurance premiums, there might be an arrangement whereby the insurer charges an annual premium and then that's recovered from the DC members on a month-by-month basis. When you get to the point where the DB is relatively small, you start to have cash flow issues where you can go into a negative position potentially, and it certainly can have solvency implications. Same goes through for issues to do with crediting rates. And when DC first started to infiltrate into DB funds, actuaries generally would value the DB assets by simply taking the value of all assets, take off the accumulation section. We still do that quite often. That can start to cause you issues if you've got tax provisions, deferred tax provisions, you've got insurance premiums. You can never be 100% sure that you've actually got the right DB assets. And if you're in the modern solvency situation where you're looking at VBI and you might be running a margin of 2 or 3% above VBI, a difference in the calculation of the assets can actually push you into a UFP, unsatisfactory financial position, where you've got to do certain things. Aside from the issues to do with solvency and cash flow management and so on, you start to then get to the point where, okay, the original DC investment strategy was generally driven by the defined benefit. Once you start to get to a point where the DB is getting small and focusing on closure and tends to become more conservative, that becomes inappropriate for DC. So at that point, you need to start thinking about different investment strategies. And we're finding now that employers in particular are driving investment strategies by their needs to manage volatility, particularly with overseas-owned companies where the overseas environment is totally different. Assets tend to be closely matched to the liabilities. There's a much wider availability of long-term bonds to do that, so there's pressure in Australia to do something similar. And we have really two situations here that we can distinguish. One is where the employer is happy to let the closed fund run down until the last member goes, and so we want to match assets to that process. The other situation is where the employer wants to convert to DC as soon as possible, whether it's by a conversion or an offer to members on a voluntary basis or a termination. And so in those circumstances, the employer will often have a target of getting into a strong financial position or a satisfactory position. Given the GFC, there's quite a few funds that are not already there. And as soon as that happens, then pull the pin and change to DC. So there's a focus on de-risking generally. And there's various ways that are done. One of the implications of de-risking, I won't spend a lot of time here, but employers often don't realise that as soon as you start de-risking the assets, you're going to affect the actuary's valuation assumptions, particularly in a pension fund where the value of the pensions depend on the long-term investment return. So you get a bit of a circular process whereby you de-risk, but the value of liabilities goes up and therefore your vested benefits index comes down. So you've got to tread a fine line between the solvency and the requirement to de-risk. There's a couple of ways, I'll skip that one in the interest of time. A couple of ways of handling investment strategy. One way is to base it on the funding level, and there are a number of funds around, have been for a while, that have a asset allocation strategy that is driven by the funding level. And so as the funding level improves, then the trustee will lock in the gain by moving to a slightly more de-risked scenario. And that might even be framed in terms of a formal document that enables the investment managers and the trustee investment committee to manage that on an ongoing basis. The other thing that's being looked at nowadays is also downside protection, and this could have relevance for DC plans and also longer-term retirement funds when we get to that. Basically, what we're talking about here is the type of strategy that used to be done using call-collar type arrangements, which tend to be fairly expensive and hard to arrange, but there are some more modern approaches that use derivatives to replicate that kind of strategy. Generally, what they provide is more of a soft floor protection rather than a hard floor. So soft floor means that there's downside protection, but there's no absolute limit to how far the assets can fall, whereas hard floor, there is a limit. And the advantage of having a soft floor is that you can recover some of the return on the upside as well, so it can be a good result. So that was everything on managing a closed fund. There's a lot more that could be said. What I'd like to just start looking at now is how we can learn from the history of DB and the legacy. If you look at DC funds nowadays, there is quite often a certain amount of what you could call DB DNA in a similar way to the Neanderthal DNA in Homo sapiens. Target benefit funds, there are still a few of those around, but you're more likely to see hybrid DB funds where there is an accumulation minimum and, a defined benefit minimum on an accumulation benefit. These provide certain challenges in managing themselves, of course. And the whole structure of death and disability benefits in DC funds tends to have been driven by the original design of DB funds, where the cover was originally a multiple of salary. Of course, we've moved away from that with the industry fund design, which is one reason why they were so radical. Tony mentioned also self-insurance. We seem to have lost self-insurance, and I can't see any good reason why a very large DC fund shouldn't be able to self-insure. At the moment, we have a situation where huge funds are causing problems for the insurers. They're very large lumps to swallow. It would be better if some of the risk could be shared across the funds and the insurance industry, insurance market. The one I'd like to just highlight there is the 30-20 rule. I think everyone here will know what the 30-20 rule is, but younger actuaries probably don't know the history of it. And it's odd when you look at when the 30-20 rule was in place, 70% of funds' assets would be invested in growth assets, properties and shares, 30% in fixed interest, 20% of it had to be in government bonds. Lo and behold, what's our standard default option nowadays? 70%, 30. Why is that? The asset consultants are able to derive all sorts of models that show us, yes, that's the optimum for the average super fund member, but it does seem very coincidental. So DB hasn't completely disappeared. Aside from the closed funds, there are also globally a number of different models that are being looked at. In particular, I'd like to mention the collective defined contribution scheme. There's been quite a bit of work done in the UK on this model. Effectively, this model pools risks across a group of members, employees, pools investment risk and also the longevity and sequencing risk. Effectively, it operates like a DC plan that buys a pension, a deferred pension, which can be adjusted from time to time. So the first safety valve is that the trustee can adjust the increase rate on the pension, emerging pensions. The second safety valve is to be able to adjust the pensions themselves. So it's effectively like a DC fund that's been re-expressed in pension terms. And that way you get away from the lump sum and the investment return focus. There are also various types of annuities. And this leads on to what we're calling the post-retirement dilemma. Tony presented earlier on the strengths of DB. And the last two really only work if you're looking at a DB pension scheme. And they relate to sequencing risk and longevity risk, which are both quite topical at the moment. And it would be nice to think, okay, we can continue doing that somehow. We can continue to use the DB model. The question is that possible? When actuaries look at retirement planning and retirement needs and so on, we tend to always focus on people who are self-funded retirees who are going to be wholly dependent on their own resources, who are not going to be entitled to the age pension. In fact, large numbers of Australians will have a partial or full age pension entitlement. And so the reality has been in the past that sequencing risk and longevity risk haven't really been as big an issue for most Australians as they might be in the future. because the age pension has been a nice little insurance policy to cover off that risk. Now, that might change in the future for various reasons, and if Joe Hockey has his way, I think it's very likely to change faster than we expect. The building up of superannuation and the controlling of the age pension longer term is probably going to put pressure. I think I might have been just... No, this slide is still relevant. Okay, so retirees are focusing on trying to make their money last as long as possible. They have a certain amount of money to last, and the dilemma is that they can't do anything, they can't change things now. Once they've got that point, they effectively have got that money, they can draw down on it. Unless they can find a product that will give them the protection they need, then they are subject to the vagaries of the market. Now, the DB experience suggests, though, that it is very hard to provide a product that covers off those risks. The DB, over a long period of time, has attempted to spread the risks across employees of a single employer, and the employers have shown that they're not prepared to accept those risks longer term. Even annuities. For a long time, we've been saying that Australians don't really like annuities. They don't really understand annuities. If they understood annuities and if the tax was better, then they would buy them just like they do overseas. Lo and behold, in the UK, where we assume that retirees are all very sophisticated, they like annuities because they like the long-term promise of a benefit. As soon as the rules are changed so they're not forced to buy annuities, they stop buying them. Not all, but some. So maybe the solution isn't necessarily to try and institutionalise the management of risk. These are personal views, and these come out of the recent discussion on longevity risk and retirement and so on. I think one of the issues for retirees is if you change the structure where we have an age pension effectively as a piece of insurance, then you are pushing the risk back on retirees who really are not in a position to manage that risk once they've finished their careers. And if longevity is an issue for our community, it shouldn't be just a negative issue. How are we going to pay for this? It should be of some form of benefit to the community. And whether it's possible for institutions, whether it's pension funds or insurance companies, to manage those risks is an open question. I'd like to comment on that. My own view is that there is a role for government in doing that. So at this point, I'd like to wrap up and hand back to our chair for some questions and hopefully comments rather than questions.
Thank you very much, Bill. And so the obligation is now to you, the audience. As Bill has posed a question for you there regarding the role of private sector, government sector, and he's given some views on what he personally believes. What's your view? Don't forget, when you are coming up, if you'd like to, there's a mic in the middle of the room there, please give your name. And please do come up and speak from the microphone so that all of this can be recorded for posterity.
Better prominence. You'd be disappointed, Tony, if I didn't ask you a question. So one of the things you touched on was the de-risking that's been really influenced by US and UK, and we're seeing a bit of it in Australia. I'd just be interested on you expanding your comments, both of the comments on how effective that de-risking really is in the Australian environment, where the DB's part of the fund is quite often the rump, and it's much harder to implement any sort of de-risking strategy on that DB part of a hybrid fund.
Thanks, Peter. First of all, I'd comment that the... by and large, the de-risking processes are at early stages, that most of the DB plans that we see still have a pretty high exposure to growth assets and so on. But a number have really abused their surpluses and have moved to very low risk strategies. One of the questions is, what was the objective of de-risking? Largely, it's been driven by the volatility on the balance sheet. I think that's been the primary issue. A secondary driver has been to really avoid complications with SPS 160, with volatility there that would create that silly situation where a deficit caused by a market movement has to be funded over a short period of time from an employer where there's very little risk of employer insolvency. I think at this stage it's a bit early to see how effective it has been largely across the sector. That's the nature of the question. But there are employers who've de-risked heavily, and those plans, well, I guess it's what you'd expect, right? The liabilities are stable and plans are stable, and in some cases the employer's paying a high contribution rate for that, and some they're not. Mostly the de-risking's happened from positions of funding strength, so that the contribution rates have been able to stay fairly stable. A side effect has been the problem for those members in those plans who had interest-based benefits. Often that was related to the earning rate on the fund. So some of those members have had to wear that largely. I think that's been the most common experience. Those members have had to either leave and go to a different environment, or they've worn that on their benefits. Is that to answer? A number of devices have been used for de-risking, I should say, and by far the most common has been the simplest one, just simply reduce the growth asset exposure, with more recently some more sophisticated techniques being used from a long-term perspective.
Not much really to add to that, except that in Australia probably the de-risking has looked more dramatic because it's been focused more on the reduction of the growth assets rather than overseas, where it tends to be more fine-tuning the fixed interest component, which was already quite significant anyway.
Okay. I probably should also, in that context, I think a lot of employers are actually looking to build surplus in the fund. So there's a bit of finessing going on here. Build surplus, find the point when you can actually convert the DB to DC. To do that, I think most people feel they need a buffer in there. They won't get that buffer so easily if they go to cash or low risk. So at this moment we're seeing a kind of finessing of that balance. Because if we asked financial controllers if they had a preference between de-risking and converting to DC, they'd say DC most times.
Can I ask a question of you, gentlemen?
Sorry.
It's hard to see from up here.
David Zaman. A lot of actuaries used to work in the super and pension area. I was one of them. I don't think I've done anything in that area for about 20 years. But just some of the historical context, different actuaries had different views as to what valuation method to use. There were disputes about what transfer value should happen between one fund and another. And I think that really confused the members, especially senior employees in an organisation, and then the employers, quite frankly, got jack of it. And then on top of that, the other big change was accounting standards. International accounting standards have had a big impact on all this whole area, and it's just too complicated to have defined benefit. So I'm just making two comments like that.
We might both comment on that. I think we agree with everything you said. Yes, it did get very complex. We have a situation where we had a accounting funding basis, the actuary's funding basis, the regulator's funding basis, and whole layers of complexity that clearly made plans complex. I'm not absolutely convinced that they were the drivers, though, for declines of DB. My own feeling is that when I see all those plans that closed, most of them closed from positions of surplus, that it really was a way of accessing that surplus. People had a feeling that they were going to get a better benefit from DC plans. So a lot of those plans that happened in the 80s and 90s from those surplus positions, some plans, of course, went and spent their surplus in other ways and probably are paying for it now.
But I think a lot of it was a lot of self-interest, as Paul Keating said, you know, back self-interest. But that was added to it. It was easy to make those decisions against the background of the complexity you talk about, of the perception of this growing issues of volatility and so on that we were seeing. But my experience of a lot of those conversions was that it was about accessing that surplus and giving members what was then seen to be a better deal. You know, members in there, you know, you would see members in funds, salaries going up at low rates, and their fund earning 12, 15% and so on, thinking, why can't I get some of that action and so on? So I think a lot of that actually was actually a driver. It's different now. Now the drivers are definitely all about volatility and getting rid of all the complexity. You've got APRA micromanaging your funding processes and so on. It just doesn't look like an easy situation to be in. But there is still a rump of members who have been through the GFC who will take a lot of shifting as it happens now. And still a lot of industrial situations where it's going to be very hard to move DB funds, notwithstanding all those comments about complexity and so on.
As Tony says, it's too easy to blame compliance, regulation and so on for the demise of or the decline of DB. If you look back in the 70s and 80s, one of the reasons why solvency management was so easy was because the resignation benefits were so low. Return of members' interests, contributions without interest when I first started in the industry. And so if your vested benefits were a fraction of assets, you were never going to have a solvency issue. But that wasn't necessarily a good thing. It wasn't necessarily a great thing to encourage employees to stay with the one job for life. So I think we have to look further than that. We may sound negative about defined benefits, which might sound a bit odd since we both derive our careers from it. We only touched on it at the end, but there are positive features of defined benefits that shouldn't be thrown out. And the longer term, we're going to have to find some way of managing members in retirement. So the focus has so far been on getting enough money at retirement to be able to do something with it. We're going to have to find ways of helping employees and members deal with that over the longer term, and some of the concepts and the techniques in defined benefits should be able to find applications there. I'd be interested if anyone in the audience actually has got any comments on that, has seen anything or worked on anything that could be of value here.
So perhaps some of that DB DNA, how could it improve our DCs? Or is there something, a completely new alternative? Thank you.
David Schneider from UniSuper, and I think Bill asked the question knowing I was in the audience. I'm not sure. UniSuper has been designing a collective defined contribution plan. There are obviously regulatory and system considerations that we're thinking through, but it's something we're giving detailed consideration to. UniSuper does have an open defined benefit plan at the moment.
Have any other opinions or please? Thanks.
Jeff Humphreys. Thank you for those thoughts. They were good. I would just like to pick up on Bill's point about self-insurance and the defined contribution funds. And it is, I support his view. It's very appropriate that where there's a capital strike going on amongst insurers for these very large funds, that door is open to them. And they'd have to obviously have similar capital requirements to insurers. But just to close the door to those funds and say, no, you've got to use a market that doesn't want to really deal with you is totally inappropriate from the regulator.
Did you read?
Yeah.
Either of you have a comment?
I agree with you. You just restated what I believe is the case.
And it's created complexities too. A lot of the insurance arrangements in these plans for both DB and DC members were very complex, a lot of legacy issues and so on, and just to simply go and try and insure them in the marketplace has not been at all easy, and it's not easy, and we're still left with a whole residual rump of self-insurance to manage anyway, and then all the other market things that you're aware of, the pricing and all those things, so it's not writing itself well, this particular story, I don't think.
I suppose it does also raise the question of what level of insurance, if any at all, is suitable for a retirement fund. And this is possibly a bit of DB legacy and DB DNA here. So if you look back at the original pension-style DB funds, once you design the fund, you work out what's an adequate level of pension. Next thing is, OK, what if someone dies before getting there? Oh, OK, we'll provide a disability pension or a death mortality pension, and if they're disabled, provide a disability pension. So then when you come and design a DC fund, you think, OK, well, we had a DB fund that had death benefits and disability benefits. We'd better have them in the DC fund. But if you were starting from scratch, designing a super guarantee system, would you necessarily put insurance cover in superannuation at all?
Anybody? Any thoughts on that commentary? Or any other questions here?
Mike Murphy. On the last point about insurance, ignoring the specifics of the sole purpose test, which talks about retirement or dependence as well, in the environment of, you know, would people do people need mortality or disability insurance regardless of superannuation? And if you answer that question with a yes, then I think the superannuation model and having that as a default and or availability to flex up and flex down does meet the needs of a very significant portion of the population. That's more a comment than a question. Referring to what about the lessons from DB for the future, there's certainly one good paper yesterday from Philip Newfield in terms of looking at the longevity risk side of the equation but not the investment risk in terms of effectively collective DC in the post-retirement space, and I found that paper very interesting and the concepts there. But it's a mutual pool of individuals wanting to be in it rather than necessarily actuarial control, but there's obviously that's a fruitful area for the actuaries to be thinking about design issues relating to something like that. Mm. And there's a paper this afternoon on the reverse mortgages scenario as well, which taps into the housing loan identification of home ownership and what the past has been and what the future might be, and again there are some aspects out of that which perhaps helpful in terms of managing the longevity side of things going forward.
Well, on that, I think there was a paper yesterday presented by Paul Newfield. I wasn't here, so I didn't see it. Did anyone attend that? So that provided one perspective on a way of pooling risk, I believe.
The issue... Oh, sorry, did you have something?
I was just going to say, one of the things, I guess one of the points we were really trying to make here is that DB plans set out with a promise of solving lots of problems and, in fact, really struggled to do it. And in some ways we're trying to use DC funds and fairly simplistic models to solve those same problems. The problems are kind of the same. We try to think somehow that despite all the lessons of DB and how difficult it's been in DB to resolve many of those issues, it's still possible to impose those same problems on the community and think they're going to be easy solutions, but I think we're saying that there are not. And I think the more people understand that and understand the interactions between all the various components of that, the better we will be and closer to solving the problem. The DB is a, if you like, is the canary in the coal mine. It tells us these are really hard problems. Even well-funded employers in a collective basis have struggled to solve these problems effectively. How can individuals do it? They need help and support.
Mm. Which goes back to our what role for the public sector and exactly. Government. Mm. Mm. One question perhaps for you two and for wider views. With relation to proposed budget changes, movement in the age pension eligibility age, the likely change in the way we work, and in fact how long we stay as a full-time person, asset testing on homes, and the issue of reverse mortgage. How do we sort that all out? So the reverse mortgage product was just raised there. Is that Is that part of the answer? What views do you two gentlemen have on post-retirement product?
Well, I'm conscious that they're gathering for lunch outside and I don't want to hold you for a moment. I think one of the things we were discussing before this session was what are the relative roles of employers, the private sector and government. And I think that's one of the things that has to be thrashed out as part of the current budget discussions. The roles of employers have pretty much crystallised, I think, whereas once employers regarded retirement funds as a valuable benefit to offer to employees, effectively now it's something they have to do, and they're not really going to be interested in extending their responsibility much outside of providing contributions. So I don't think really employers are going to have much of a role in post-retirement. The private sector has a role, and there's an opportunity to offer products. So far we haven't seen cost-effective products that appeal to the public. I think the government still does have a role, and the idea that we can reduce the cost of the age pension down to something under defence spending is just pie in the sky.
That's a question that is so broad with so many elements to it, and I've got such a broad range of opinions on so many parts of it that I don't really want to address it, to be honest. But I will say that it is such an important question with so many elements covering individuals, covering politics, covering finance, covering capital, covering where this country might even go in so many ways, that it would be nice to think that the people that ultimately make key decisions about that are well informed on the issues. It's not always evident to me that the people who are making those decisions are well informed on those issues. And I think the Institute, if it can have a role and a voice that is loud enough in those forums, can be of great assistance. Whether they currently are in a position to do that, I'm not sure. But there are a lot of people in this room and in this conference who would have a lot of very useful and helpful things to say to illuminate that very, very large and important debate. And I hope that one of our objectives as an institute is to try and reliably inform that whole question, because we've got a lot to say about it, and it can't just look like vested interest. So if it's the voice of someone purporting to be connected to an obvious vested interest, I think that could be a problem. But there's a long and important debate to be had, and I hope the Institute has a big part to play in it.
Thank you, Tony. And that actually is a perfect wrap-up, I think, for our session today. So thank you. Thank you all for participating and providing your views. Particularly thank you to our two speakers, to Bill and to Tony, for an introduction into what is actually a very interesting and wide-ranging issue that we face. So can you please put your hands together for Tony and Bill.